Are you looking to connect with a diverse audience of developers? Look no further. You can partner with us here at the Code Newbie Podcast, and we'll help get your message out to our incredible listeners in an ad just like this one, led by me, your host. Contact us by emailing sponsors@codenewbie.org. Welcome to the Code Newbie Podcast, where we talk to people on their coding journey in hopes of helping you on yours. I'm your host, Ron, and for the month of March, we've partnered with Scott Hanselman of the Hansel Minutes Podcast to bring you stories on making. Now, we usually talk about software for the show, but for this month, we're bringing you some hardware stuff as well. So stay tuned and make sure you subscribe to Scott's show, Hansel Minutes, for a lineup of awesome guests in the makerspace. For great maker content all month long, make sure to follow us on Twitter at CodeNewbies and check out MarchIsForMakers.com. So before we get to our third hardware-flavored guest, I want to tell you about the incredible sponsors who are supporting our Code Newbie community. Today on the show, I'm so excited to have Kristen Smith. She is the lead of the New York chapter of Women in Hardware and the retail account manager at Little Bits. Kristen, you want to say hi?
Hi, how are you doing, Saran?
I'm doing well. So I actually reached out to you on Twitter a little while ago, and I was hoping and praying that I'd get a response, and then I did, and it worked out, and now we're here. So I'm so excited to have you on the show.
I love Twitter. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining. We have so many different things we could talk about, and I want to start with your work in Women in Hardware. So tell us a little bit about what that is and how it came to be.
Yeah, so Women in Hardware, really, it's really an initiative. It's a network across San Francisco, Boston, and New York. Women in Hardware was founded by a girl named Kate McAndrew. So when Kate McAndrew started investing in hardware startups at Bolt, she really had only invested in one hardware startup prior. And so as we all do when we're starting something new, we set up those coffees and we try to get information from people and tips and tricks on how to be awesome in our new career. And Kate realized that all of the women that she was meeting with were extremely generous with their time and really going that extra mile to make sure Kate got that next connection, got that next opportunity, or even following up with Kate to make sure that she was being successful. And she noticed that these women that she was meeting with didn't know each other and was kind of baffled by that, right? Like, how do these kick-ass ladies not know of one another? And was really inspired not only by what they were doing for her, but really inspired by the opportunity to connect those females. And then Kate and I got connected through Bolt, actually. I remember initially Bolt on their website, I think it was just all men on their team. And I was talking to a gentleman who works at Bolt, and I was giving him a hard time. I was like, what's going on here? I'm only seeing men on this website. And he was like, no, we just hired two women. They're starting soon. And so when I went to a Bolt event, I met Kate and I said, oh my gosh, you're the lady they hired. Like, gave her the biggest hug, and it was just like instant friendship from there. And so I was in San Francisco. She's like, you know, if you could just like lend me a hand, I've got this event tonight. I'm not really sure what's going to happen, but like I could use some help. I'm like, yeah, this Women in Hardware event sounds great. So she launched the first event at of Women in Hardware in San Francisco at Pier 9. And if you're not familiar with Pier 9, Pier 9 is sponsored by Autodesk and has the most top-notch maker facilities anyone could ever dream of. So the event was with the most amazing meat and cheese plate, delicious wine, and a tour of that workshop at Autodesk's Pier 9 facilities. Crazy successful event, right? We thought we would maybe have 20 attendees. I believe we had upwards of like 40 to 50. We thought it would last about 2 hours. Ended up going all night. Was really, really great. We also brought in Lumi, and we had girls screen printing their own bags, making some really cool Women in Hardware swag. So then I took a flight back to New York, and, you know, a few weeks had passed, and I was just still like running on the energy and thrill from that event. I called up Kate and I was like, Kate, we need to bring this to New York. She's like, yep, I was thinking the exact same thing. I know how we need to do it. So we launched in New York a few months later at the Little Bits headquarters with Jenny Lawton, who was the previous CEO of MakerBot, who's now COO at Little Bits. She just gave an amazing, amazing, intimate fireside chat about balancing life and working in a crazy hardware startup space and gave some really, really good tips to women in the industry. And then a few weeks later, we launched in Boston. So it's been great and gaining crazy momentum.
That is so awesome. And what I love about that is it sounds like the goal of it is really to leverage existing resources, right? Each of these women, it sounds like, has their own network, their own skill set, things that they're doing that they can share. Yeah. And it's really leveraging that by creating a community that's really supportive and really built on sharing, right? This idea that if we all succeed, then, you know, that's better than me kind of hoarding all my info and all my data and just looking out for me, right? It's much healthier for us to bring all of us up together.
100%. So it's twofold, right? There's two different ways to do that that we try to with women in hardware. The first is really bringing every type of individual to these events that is supporting hardware. So it's definitely founders. It's also the investors. It's people like myself who are in sales, making sure these units get sold of hardware. And it's everyone at every single stage, from small, medium to large hardware companies. And then it's also exposing people to sides of hardware that they might not be familiar with. So we often visit various different locations and have content experts speak on behalf of those locations. So that could be manufacturing, that could be marketing, that could be founders just talking about where they're at in the process and sharing tips. So it's making those connections and giving that content as well.
And that's the thing that I find so interesting about your story and your background, because you don't come from, you know, a hardware or computer science background. You actually majored in photography and art history in undergrad.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I'm the one when it goes into engineering coding speak, I'm like, whoa, over my head. But definitely, yeah, I've got the art history background.
So tell me a little bit about how that background has influenced your role and your perspective in the hardware movement.
Yeah, so after University of Colorado, getting a fine art degree, I got really interested in the museum industry. So I gained experience at two amazing institutions, Denver Art Museum, and then shortly after MoMA in New York. And what I realized in these spaces is only one person was allowed or is allowed or to be creative, being the curator. And so I thought, you know, I love this museum thing, but I don't think fine art is for me. And so I moved back to Milwaukee and I started working part-time at a science and technology museum called Discovery World, right? And at the time, I thought I like failed. I'm like, oh man, I didn't make it in New York. I'm here in Milwaukee at this tiny museum. What's wrong with me? And little did I realize it was the exact spot I wanted to be and like needed to be at. So the museum, Discovery World in Milwaukee, is dedicated to innovation and fresh water. So it's really empowering people to understand and value fresh water through making products with fresh water. So that could be perfumes, that could be molecular gastronomy, tea, or that could be teaching adults the chemistry of fresh water through brewing beer. So once we make things with fresh water, we're going to value that fresh water more and then start being more conservative with it. And then the other half of the museum is dedicated to innovation and innovators that are homegrown here in Milwaukee, such as Rockwell. And Milwaukee is such a maker manufacturing town as well. So that kind of was where my roots are from. But anyway, the museum has great exhibits. But what really spoke to me and carved out my future was our 10 labs and studios. So there was a biology lab where we're dissecting fish and quagga mussels, an electronics lab where we're teaching kids circuitry and soldering. We have a smart adhesives lab and screen printing lab. And then we also have a video studio and an audio studio. And all of these great spaces are sponsored by local corporations here in Milwaukee. And we got this great opportunity through Kohl's Department Stores. Their nonprofit arm is called Kohl's Cares. And they gave us a donation to start an industrial design lab makerspace called the Kohl's Design It Lab. And this was really one of the first makerspaces in the U.S., launched in 2012. It was designed as a cafe. So you got a menu, and we had waiters and waitresses. However, we served no food. On the menu was all these different projects that you could make from 5 minutes all the way up to 30 minutes. It was teaching materials and methods, as well as points for ideation and inspiration, such as biomimicry. So for example, we might give a family the material Tyvek. If you're not familiar with Tyvek, it's actually 100% recycled material and it's plastic based. It's used in construction. So if you see homes that are being built, they have almost like a paper-like substance that is on the outside protecting the building while it's being built. We brought that material into the makerspace and taught people basic folding techniques and gave them a heat sealer. So they used a heat sealer to make seams to make a wallet. So we're talking about prototyping, using a cheap material and a really quick tool like a heat sealer to fold and take something from 2D to 3D and making a product. And then the waiters and the waitresses, they of course were not serving food or even had experience in restaurants. They were industrial designers, they were engineers, they were architects, whether they were students or recent graduates, and really teaching people these materials and methods to make. And then next door in our workshop, we had the heavier hitting tools such as laser cutters, 3D printers, CNC machines, really the full gamut to help people understand the process of how things are made.
That is so cool. I'm like sitting awesome. Here at the edge of my seat. That's it was so cool.
It's really, really magical. But what's unique about makerspaces is kind of when this movement started, no one really knew kind of exactly, am I doing the right thing? We're having a lot of challenges here. Are you guys doing the same thing? And I remember I was trying to get the team motivated and I said, you know, we are the only makerspace that's like a cafe in the world, you know, and I had clearly not done my research. And one of our lead designers said, you know, Kristen, you're wrong. And I was like, okay, fine. Like, show me what you think we're like. And they sent me a link to Fab Cafe. And so Fab Cafe is a global maker cafe network. They were launched in Tokyo. And so I'm on their initial website and I fill in the blank box that says, you know, send us your comments. And I say, I'm Kristen Smith. I'm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We've got this makerspace called the Kohl's Design It Lab. We're like a cafe and I'd love to connect. And I remember I got an email with all of this Japanese in my inbox. And I was like, oh my gosh, they replied and just was freaking out in Milwaukee. And so that started amazing conversations via Skype, where we got to learn from one another. And then I soon learned that Fab Cafe is not only in Tokyo, they are in Taipei, Barcelona, and Bangkok. And at the museum, my mentor and our creative executive director ended up retiring. So I thought, you know, I'm ready to move on. And I reached out to the Fab Cafe Network and said, I know you want to start a Fab Cafe in the U.S. I'd love to help you. So they said, yeah, let's do it. And I said, where do you want to start it? And they said, we want to start in New York. And so they connected me to a gentleman who's working to launch Fab Cafe in New York named Nobuhiro Seki. And he said, how about you go live in Japan? Get to know these people, get to learn their processes. Let's leverage the partnerships that they already have. So I packed my bags and I moved to Tokyo. I lived there for 3 months. I was stationed at Fab Cafe Tokyo, but did side trips to Hong Kong, where we did a pop-up in Hysan Place Shopping Mall. I also went to Taipei and then helped them launch Fab Cafe in Bangkok as well. And then shortly after, moved to New York and was helping to get Fab Cafe New York off the ground. And as you know, it can take a while to get investment. So while we are still working to launch Fab Cafe here in New York, I actually found an opportunity with Little Bits. They launched a pop-up space in Soho. And so I helped Little Bits run their pop-up store in Soho, which was from September 2015 to January 2016. It's not there anymore. I should say it was just a pop-up. The pop-up popped down. And now after that popped down, I found myself on the retail team selling Little Bits via wholesale to brick-and-mortar retailers here in the U.S.
Wow, your life is so exciting.
Okay, you're too nice.
I'm so serious. I want to be in a situation where I just email some random person in some other country and then I'm like, yeah, you know, why don't we start this thing? And they're like, yeah, just go to Japan for a couple of months. That's just amazing. That's just great.
What boggles my mind is what's happening more and more is we're finding people are getting into these careers that didn't exist 2 years ago, 6 months ago. And I'm a strong believer that, you know, opportunities don't fall in your lap. You really have to go get them. And you really have to seek out what you want. And I think that through people seeking out what they want, they're developing these positions and a path for themselves that didn't exist before. And I think that's through collaboration and conversation and just like making the connection, which is why Women in Hardware is so powerful, just creating ecosystems for people to make more connections.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that someone asked me recently, you know, what do you want to do in like 5 years? And I'm like, I don't even know what jobs will be around in 5 years, you know, and I think this idea of just always being open to potential opportunities and things that might turn into opportunities that may not look like opportunities, or just keeping your options open is really important. It sounds like by you just reaching out and always being in this mindset of networking and connecting with people, right, it sounds like you've ended up in a really good spot.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's something you just have to keep doing. You know, sometimes it's hard to get up an hour early, you know, to grab that coffee before you're supposed to be at work leave your cozy bed for that event. I think every time you do it, it's always worth it. And there's very few times I ever regretted not putting myself out there.
Yeah, definitely. So the thing that I find very interesting about your story is, you know, and I'm thinking back to all the friends that I have who were art majors and art history majors and who did, you know, I was a liberal arts major myself. I majored in English and psychology. And so, you know, coming from that perspective of always dissecting and being a very good observer, I feel like, and, you know, being very detail oriented, but still being able to connect the dots, I can imagine that being just a huge asset when you're moving to a different industry and you're kind of thrown into something like retail, which seems very different from kind of creating this maker experience. And so I'm wondering, you know, have you found your fine arts background to be an asset or more of a hindrance in your journey?
It's interesting. It's a really good question I haven't thought about before. My approach to artwork or anything that I put out there was 100% like an improv approach, like grab materials from here, grab materials from there. And I often like wouldn't really know what the output was going to be until I was like in the middle of a project, you know, where I just started trying things out. And I was like, oh, I kind of like where this is going. Let's take it further. And I think that has just been my approach to anything new. So whether it is fostering an environment for people to make and create, all the way to bringing that makerspace mentality into retail. And so I think it's just a scrappy approach of like understanding what the full breadth of resources, at your disposal could be. So my approach is definitely a lot of discovery when I'm launching something new. Just talking to collaborators and partners and these retailers and saying, what do you have? And asking leading questions and figuring out what's even possible. And then from there, just trying something new and putting together a plan of how you can make amazingness happen. And of course, we are so lucky in the technology that's at our fingertips, of how easy it is to connect with people that are halfway around the US or halfway around the world, to share information and even like show them things via video as well. So I like leveraging both technology and then understanding other resources that are already in at play.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a little bit, because it sounds like for you to have created a great, you know, design it lab and to work on Fab Cafe and to, you know, work on Retail and Little Bits, you have to understand to some degree, you know, you have to have kind of a working knowledge of the maker space and some of the tech terms and some of how things work. How have you dealt with that learning curve?
Yeah. If I were to like make a title for myself, it would be a network developer and champion for collaboration. Nice. So the number one way I did that was just through meeting as many people as I possibly could and visiting as many spaces as I possibly could to really understand, what is it that you do? What is this term you're saying that I don't get? And how do these systems work? What's crazy about hardware and making things is previously, before the maker movement, this information was really industry secrets and kind of behind closed doors. And through the maker movement and, you know, this ability to share information and knowledge so quickly, those industry secrets have bubbled up to the table. And so it's really uncovering those and seeking them out and just connecting with people who are already in the network, just to learn their processes and figure out how they do it. I'm terrible at reading and studying. One of my like pet peeves is when, you know, it's the conversation of, have you read this latest article, or, you know, making sure you're up on the top 10 things coming out of Fast Company. And I was just overwhelmed by like, how do you guys keep up with it?
It's so much stuff.
So I just found talking to people and conversations is the best way to learn.
Yeah, ever since I subscribed to Medium, every article that comes into my inbox feels so urgent. And it's all like, if you're doing this and you're doing it all wrong, like it all sounds like that. And I'm like, oh my God, everything I know is incorrect. Right. It's become an issue.
Definitely an issue.
Yeah. So I know that one of the big issues that's come up in the Code Newbie community is people wanting to go to meetups, wanting to go to these hackathons, hack nights, you know, whatever you want to call it, but feeling very, very self-conscious about just not knowing enough, about not being able to follow the conversation, about meeting some senior developer who knows all the big words and doesn't really explain anything. And it feels like with your title, you know, as the network developer, I think is what you called it, it sounds like you're probably in a lot of the situations where you're constantly talking to people who have a level of expertise that you just don't have. Have you ever felt self-conscious about that, and how have you dealt with it?
Yeah. I think that there's two options when we are put into situations like that. And I've definitely taken both paths, right? One option in that conversation is to be passive and you're just kind of doing the nod and like, you're
I totally get it, right?
And I'm, you know, like I think we all, especially in New York, we're such like people pleasers and like great conversationalists where we like can give these cues where we're like keeping the conversation going even when we're secretly like, I have no clue what this individual is talking about.
Yep.
And then the second approach is, you know, taking a pause and being like, oh, you know, I'm not familiar with that. Can you tell me more? And I think in my previous career, you know, when I was much younger, fresh out of college, I definitely took the approach and made sure to make a mental note and was researching things like crazy later. And I just realized that there's no reason, you know, not to pause and just ask someone to explain it further. With that being said, though, I think that I had a really, really great manager at early on who really taught me how important it is to do your homework and really be prepped. So yes. If I was going into a meeting with someone who was really important or going into an event at a company that was pretty big, I definitely made sure to do my research going into that situation, knowing what is the latest article, what's the latest product this company put out, or what is the latest thing that this individual has done. And I think maybe also being from the Midwest, I'm such a sucker for like personal connections. So I would also like try to research what these individuals are like personally interested in, whether it's like tall ship schooners or, you know, whatever book or maybe food they're interested in, and connecting them with on a personal level outside of this super technical industry speak, and just making the situation a little bit more comfortable. But I think it's also a personality thing too. I've always been really comfortable in new situations. So just putting yourself out there and doing it over and over and over and over again would definitely be my tip.
I love that you said that, because there really are two paths. You know, you can either be more passive or you can just kind of own up to not knowing and, you know, and get the benefit of now knowing, right? You'll never not know that thing again. And one thing for me that's helped is when I don't know something, I will be very, very excited about the idea that I'm about to learn it. You know what I mean? So I'll say, oh my God, I've never heard of that before. Please tell me everything you know, you know, and it kind of, instead of highlighting the fact that I didn't know, I'm highlighting the fact that the other person is an expert of that topic, right? And it makes them feel good to educate me. So yeah, that's a helpful way to navigate that as well.
Yeah, and I think the maker hardware industry is so on this wave of sharing knowledge that you have such little to lose, because people have this mentality, just like you're saying, they are eager to share and to teach one another. So always go for it.
So I want to talk a little bit about what a good makerspace involves. You've worked on, you know, really three makerspaces, right? With Kohl's Design It Lab, with your work at Fab Cafe, and even the Little Bits pop-up store. You know, there was an element of it being a creative space to make, not just to, you know, go in and purchase products. What have you found over the years of elements of a good makerspace?
Yeah. The common thread through Kohl's Design It Lab, Fab Cafe, and the Little Bits pop-up store, I would say that each space was extremely public-facing, that the barriers were so low for people to just walk in or even stumble in, you know, not knowing what they were getting themselves into. And then the level of excitement within the space, both within the design of the space as well as the staff running the space, was extremely high. So in the Kohl's Design It Lab, it was this dynamic environment, right? It's loud, vacuum formers are running, we're playing like great music. Within the Little Bits pop-up store, using Little Bits, all of these awesome displays were buzzing and blinking, just drawing people in. And then with Fab Cafe, it's inviting people. People are familiar with a cafe setting, so it's inviting them into a comfortable space to have a cup of coffee, and then encouraging them, or almost approaching them to come check out the laser cutting project or come learn about 3D printing or even try their first 3D print. So I think what makes a makerspace really successful is when it's intentionally open and for everyone. And there's lots of different elements that can be scary within a maker space. You picture the soldering iron and right. 100 electronic components out on the table. I don't think there's many people who are not familiar with engineering electronics who would sit down in that chair. So figuring out what is the environment going to be that is going to invite people in. And then I have a lot of tips too around, or just learnings, I should say, around what makes a good first experience in making. If you think about making, I think about it as a spectrum. So you have to go from making to becoming a maker. I often like to start people what I call as like putting together something that's pre-designed. So it's learning a making technique. So it could be slotting and tabbing. It could be seams using a heat sealer or a sewing machine. And a good first way to get people making is just to have them create something that a designer has already made. They're putting it together. Another good technique to do that is often copying something. Say, okay, here's this object. Copy it exactly. Is it going to look like that thing does verbatim? No, but they're going to learn a process of making while they're trying to do that. The second is like fake customization. So you're giving the material and method, but you're allowing them as a newcomer to make some sort of decision in the making process. So with the fake customization, it's often like a structure that is already designed, and then they're customizing maybe a skin of that structure or one element of the structure. So they're now really putting a personal touch on it. I think when you start getting into the fake customization, that is really where people start getting attached to what they make. Anytime you are using your hands to make a product and it's got a personal touch on it, you are connected to that object. And it is the best thing anybody has ever, you know, put out there. And of course, you're going to want to take it home. And then finally, it's really building from the ground up, where you're starting fresh, ideation, you're defining the materials and methods, and you're really shaping what that product is going to be. Of course, there's lots of many different ways to make in between, but I often think about this spectrum and figuring out where people are already at in their lives. That's going to kind of be that hook or that lure to get them interested and to get them started making, figuring out what a good starting point for people is. Does that make sense? I don't know if that makes even sense.
Yeah, no, I love that there's a framework for it. I never thought of it that way, but that makes a lot of sense. There's kind of these four places to hit, these four stops, right, on the making journey, which I really love. I feel like the step between 3 and 4 is probably the biggest jump.
Right, right.
Right? And so when it comes to designing maker spaces, do you feel like that is the right place, the right environment to help people get from 3 to 4, or do you end up focusing more on 1, 2, 3?
That's a good question. I think that we have the tendency to use this blanket term makerspace, right? And saying it's like everyone there, it's one shoe, one size fits all. One size fits all. And that is so not the case. I think that the most successful makerspaces are the ones that are clearly defining who their audiences are and tailoring experiences around that audience. So you're exactly right. All of the makerspaces that I've run and have been a part of really were in that initial phase, luring people in, getting them to get their hands on some tools and materials, and then really pushing them off to the next step. Whether that next step is, you know, finding the next advanced makerspace that is going to have the crazy metal soldering equipment, the, you know, carbon fiber 3D printer, or maybe it's off to go get a degree in this, or maybe it's even to the next accelerator. Finding that sweet spot of where you fit in the ecosystem, defining who your audience is, I think makes the best experience within these makerspaces. And I would say that all of my experience has been in this early stage beginner, first time maker arena.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. So for people who generally join makerspaces and, you know, stop by to do stuff, do you find that they come kind of already educated and already knowing what's going on and looking to explore it? Or do you find that a big part of your job is to get people familiar with and acquainted with just the concept of making?
Yeah, I'd say that most of the people that stumble into these spaces have no idea what they're walking into and know nothing about the maker movement or these tools. And that's really by design. So with each of these spaces, it's locating near somewhere where people are just going to stumble in. So in the museum, right, people were wandering these exhibits. They open this giant, beautiful glass door, and it's kind of like, what's in here? And they're intrigued. Fab Cafe, it's a cafe. People are hungry. They want coffee, and they stumble in and say, oh, wow, look at what's here. And then in Soho, it's these families and these New Yorkers who are just shopping and having a nice, beautiful Saturday in Soho and see a beautiful, blinking, buzzing window display, and they're kind of intrigued. I think in, you know, 9 times out of 10, the first question out of somebody's mouth within all these spaces is, what is this? And it's giving them like, well, here's what it is, and here's how you can get started. And that's really what's magical. And I think if you think about, you know, my previous experience and what I'm so excited about moving forward and just general maker movement and this growth of hardware, it's bringing these experiences into the mainstream so we can just expose more and more people who have no clue or who, you know, aren't even seeking it out to start making and start really democratizing hardware and the making process, which is what Little Bits' mission is. So, you know, doing mini maker fair at 650 Barnes & Noble locations all across the U.S. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
So what do you hope is your long-term impact on the maker movement? You know, you've already done so much with Kohl's, you know, now Little Bits with Fab Cafe. And I'm wondering, you know, where do you hope that your work leads you in the next, you know, 5-10 years in making?
I really hope that my work will almost have the term maker movement not be a term anymore that needs to be spoken about when someone is sitting down to have these experiences or when people are buying products like Little Bits or when they are, you know, doing their science project and they're incorporating electronics. I think that I really hope to refine things that have come from the maker movement so they are more approachable for people and more ingrained in our everyday. I think at Little Bits, we're really inspired by a testimonial we got from one parent that was said, you know, I'm not going to wait for my kid to grow up to be an engineer. They're going to be an engineer now. So I'm not sure if this is making sense, but really like incorporating it into people's everyday lives where it's just mainstream. Like think about the like desktop printer, right? Like, oh my gosh, those things used to be so huge, so expensive, and you would only print, right? You'd only print like the most important document. Now everyone's got a printer. They're super cheap and, you know, people were printing like crazy. And it was just something that people had and didn't think twice about. And I kind of hope that this maker movement, understanding the electronics around you, creating with electronics, putting products out there, really becomes mainstream. I mean, I'm not saying let's have so many people launch hardware companies or we want to make makers out of everyone, but that these experiences will be much, much easier to access if you want to seek it out.
Yeah, and I think that the way you're doing that is very interesting because a lot of times when we talk about making technology accessible, we mean making it really cheap and making it, you know, really easy to use. But what you're talking about isn't just that. That's also important, but it's also bringing it, you know, to certain communities and different places and creating experiences around that cheap, accessible, affordable technology.
Definitely.
So that people are interested enough to give it a try.
Definitely. I think that that is really a cornerstone mission of Little Bits. We say we're democratizing hardware. And just like you said, people's first instinct is really they assume we're talking about price. And of course, at Little Bits, we're always working to bring the cost of Little Bits down. But democratizing hardware is really taking the experience of creating with electronics, taking it out of these labs, taking it out of these top-notch innovation facilities, bringing it into the living room, bringing it into the classroom. And in democratizing it, it's lowering the barriers to entries. We're talking about magnets. No longer are people having to sit hours and hours with a soldering iron, work with these tiny electronic components to get their feet wet and learn electronics. They can literally within seconds learn a color coding system, create circuits, and develop solutions for their everyday lives. Like, I think this is crazy, right? Like, when I was a kid, I would cut up cardboard and I would use tape and I'd make this imaginary thing. But now these kids are making the real thing, right? They're making like low-level prototypes and it's functioning and it's going to function for, you know, a year if they wanted to. It's like less a lifetime. That just boggles my mind.
And it reminds me of an interview we had recently with Danilo, who now works at GitHub, and he's working on a project, I think we call the episode Internet for All, where it's, you know, a government-funded project to bring the internet to low-income housing and in places where they just don't have high-speed internet. And when we talk about the software movement and learning to code, that, you know, even though software is, you know, especially open source software, right, is free, and it's not, you know, it's not me having to buy equipment and, you know, buy a lot of that stuff, there's still a barrier to entry just in the form of being able to access those resources. And so I'm wondering, have you put any thought or, you know, worked on the issue of how do we democratize hardware to the point where people who don't have the best internet connection, people who are in, you know, impoverished communities where even they can have access to all the wonderful experiences of making?
Mm-hmm. What I cannot speak higher to Kohl's Department Stores and Kohl's Cares. So they funded a program and their funds went to make sure that everything anybody did in the Kohl's Design It Lab was completely free. So whether that was a family sitting down to invent, a school coming in for a 45-minute to 3-hour workshop, or even people, just everyday visitors dropping into that space, everything was completely free. Oh, I forgot to mention, the Kohl's Design It Lab also had a mobile lab. So we had this awesome box truck that we would pack with the educators, the materials, and we would send it out to communities. As we here in Milwaukee, it was a big issue that these schools just don't have the funding, even for transportation. Mm-hmm. Even if we're saying museum admission is free, come to the Kohl's Design It Lab, it'll be free. They couldn't possibly get here. So packing up that Kohl's Design It mobile lab, sending it out to the community, and meeting people where they're at to give them those experiences.
Oh, that is so awesome. And that's still something that continues now?
Yeah, definitely.
That's great. And I guess the last part I'd love to get into a little bit is kind of just the logistics and the business around putting together a makerspace. You mentioned earlier that you're currently working on Fab Cafe in New York and how getting investment and getting kind of the money together has been, you know, a thing to do. And I'd love for you to speak a little bit more to the behind the scenes that people just may not really think about when they think about making. You know, what are the players? Who are the players? What are the pieces that you have to coordinate to be able to put on something like the Kohl's Design It Center?
Yeah. In terms of costs, you're going to have the physical space. So you're going to have a square footage cost to just open up shop. Obviously, that's going to drastically change when you're talking about Milwaukee versus New York. Then you have to pay for the tools. So what's hard about a makerspace is you're going to have a 3D printer, you're going to have a CNC machine, a laser cutter. These are not cheap tools. And furthermore, these tools are, you know, the rate at which the newest innovative tool is coming out to, you know, make the one that you just bought out of date, that happens so fast. So there's a heavy, heavy burden on purchasing those tools and making sure they are up to date. After that, you're going to need to pay for materials and consumables. So that's going to be your, you know, the vinyl for the vinyl cutter, that's going to be your acrylic for the laser cutter, your cardboards, anything, the filament for the 3D printer. And then your staff. You're going to have your team who is on the ground floor teaching your customers, running the equipment. And then there's always going to be some additional like managerial director staff. And then if you are running a cafe, of course, you're going to have your food and beverage and your, you know, the consumables for the cups and the napkins. So those are going to be all the costs. Traditionally, I think this is why Fab Cafe is such a unique model. Traditionally, if a makerspace may just be, you know, you pay your cost per minute to make your product on the 3D printer and you pay for the materials like the filament and you walk out. But with all of these costs, just that one way transaction, you know, just the one offering makes it really hard for a makerspace to survive, right? And keep updating their equipment. So what's unique about something like Fab Cafe is they're bringing in, they're diversifying their revenue streams to make to really support the making in that space. So they're bringing in food and beverage. They're hosting events, whether it's meetups, you know, workshops, things of that nature, to really find ways to get additional dollars to support that space.
Very cool. So having like a multi-purpose space really helps.
Yes. And also developing partnerships with these equipment producers. What's interesting is someone who's just getting into making, let's say they learn how to laser cut on a Trotec laser cutter. Chances are, or, you know, the chances of that person growing into a designer, you know, it might happen where this person is going to keep elevating in their career. Now they're launching a design firm and they need to purchase equipment. Chances are that they learn maybe on a Trotec laser cutter, they're probably going to feel more comfortable bringing that laser cutter into their space. So it's reaching out to these equipment producers and saying, hey, we have exposure that we can give you to your equipment. We'd love to create some type of partnership, maybe even shared revenue stream, where if you place your equipment in our space, we'll give you the exposure. And then you can allow it to be maybe more of like a rental situation, where then they're going to swap out that equipment for the newest, latest, greatest machine. And that helps keep the heavy burden and cost of that equipment off of the makerspace itself.
So for those different revenue streams, I'm wondering, are those things that you've figured out through your years in the industry and lots of experimentation, or those kinds of traditional things that people have always done, whether it's in the makerspace or outside of it?
Definitely learned through the industry and learned through trying, you know, people trying innovative solutions and kind of seeking out like, oh, they're trying something new. I want to learn that.
Great. So what's next for you? What are you going to do? You know, what can we look forward to in the maker space from Kristen Smith?
Yeah, so I'm actually pretty fresh in this position at Little Bits. So as I mentioned, I'm really working to bring Little Bits to domestic brick and mortar retail across the U.S. And it's not just putting Little Bits on a shelf. It's really activating retail with Little Bits. So that's through, you know, demoing for people trying their first snap with Little Bits in a place like Barnes & Noble or Marbles the Brain Store, and furthermore, events and creating micro maker spaces in retail across the U.S. So I'm very excited, you know, that people all around the U.S., no matter where they live, will be able to access things like that. And they don't, you know, need to be in New York to, or located near New York to check out the really cool Little Bits pop-up store. They can go to their local retailer. So I'm really excited about that.
We're excited too. So please keep us posted on what you're up to and the awesome things that we're doing. We'd love to hear about it.
Saran, thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure.
So you ready to do some fill in the blanks?
Oh, yeah.
Number one, worst advice I've ever received is?
The worst advice I ever received was, I think that early on in my career, someone, I had like a super powerful boss. And my manager at the time told me, you know, not to ask too many questions, you know, not to piss him off.
Brother.
And I remember that I just was like so scared to ask questions in this particular situation. No. And then I remember just getting, he asked me to do a task and it just like blew up because I didn't know X, Y, and Z. So I'd say worst advice, don't ask questions.
That's a good worst advice. I like that one. My first coding project was about?
So Little Bits has an Arduino coding kit, and I had not coded previously. And I said, I need to learn some coding. I want to learn how to use this Arduino. And so my first coding project was on the Little Bits Arduino bit, and I made a LED dance party. It was so basic, but like, again, I was so proud.
That's awesome. Wait, what is an LED dance party? What does that look like?
So what's cool with the Arduino coding kit is you, a software developer, can like immediately, instantly get into hardware development because you're coding on the Arduino a little bit, and then you can add all these cool outputs like lights, motion, and sound. So I just went to town attaching LEDs to my Arduino bit, and I was like putting them like with stickies all over my room, and it was turned off the lights, LED dance party, threw on some good tunes.
That's
super
amazing.
Basic. It was awesome.
That sounds like fun. One thing I wish I knew when I first started to code is
just start coding. Like just start. I think that I was so scared of it before, and I didn't realize it's one of these things that you just need to just do and do more of. I found out recently that in Florida, they just declared coding as a foreign language.
Oh, that's so awesome.
Yeah, and I was like, wow, that like really is how I need to start thinking about coding. Foreign languages, you need to do often and you need to exercise often. So just carving out the time to code if you're passionate about it and doing it often.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I like that one. That's a good one. So now for some shout outs. Do you have a couple for us?
Definitely. I think one that's really near and dear to my heart that I think has just really flooded the New York hardware scene with some really great resources is the NYC EDC Next Top Maker program. Next Top Maker program is a community sourced incubator dedicated to makers and hardware startups that are developing new products and methods of production. So if you think about New York, we have such few resources for people to access these tools and the materials, and furthermore, like the expertise as well as the funding. So the Next Top Maker program has a cohort of startups, and it's really connecting them to all of these really great resources. But they are like so community driven and like arms wide open that they have so many awesome events and opportunities for people who are not within their cohort to get involved and make those connections. So I'd highly suggest attending their open events and just seeing what that program is all about. And then I think that my another good tip or book that I've read, although I work for a little bit, so it's like a little, I still think it's a really valuable resource, even though I worked there.
Go for it.
The Little Bits collaborated with Make magazine, and the book Make, Getting Started with Little Bits, is the quickest train read ever, and just finally gets you to understand electronics, all the electronics around you, and what they do and how they work, literally, like in the easiest, quickest way. The story I like to share is like it finally electronics finally clicked in my mind when I was using a public ladies restroom. Ladies, I'm not sure if you have ever been using a restroom where there's an automatic flusher, and it's so annoying because you sit down and it always flushes when you're not ready for it to flush, and it usually is a really annoying experience that was like one day clicked in my head, and I was like, oh my gosh. That is a motion trigger. That's a motion trigger whose the sensitivity isn't set correctly. And I remember, like, after reading that book, I had that experience, and it just, like, clicked for me. And I forever, like, now I feel like I understand. So check out that book.
That's awesome. And I've got a few personal shout outs. So I'm going to shout out Little Bits as well, specifically the Little Bits community. And this to me is probably one of the most impressive part of Little Bits, because, you know, lots of companies are doing hardware. Lots of them are catering to the more beginner community and trying to make it just very appealing and inviting. But the thing that just really stands out about Little Bits is just the investment in creating a space, right? A community of people to get together and really try hardware and make stuff and share. And there are, let me see, over 200 chapters in 50 locations around the world. And that to me is so, so impressive. And just says a lot about the investment of them into like the people, like the makers themselves, as well as the things that you use to make. So see if there's one in your community, join it, give it a try, and let us know what you think. And my second shout out is a really great list called 16 Women You Need to Know About Who Founded Hardware Software Startups. And usually when I hear about lists about, you know, different diversity lists around people in tech, it's usually, it almost always ends up being software focused. It almost always ends up being, you know, some type of a tech product. And this is one of the few that I found that actually mixes up software and hardware. So definitely check it out. It has some really great people, including the founder of Little Bits, also the founder of Adafruit, Lamour. Is it Freed? Am I saying that right?
Yes.
Lamour Freed, yeah. Meredith Perry, who started Ubeam, which is this awesome wireless electricity company. So if you're just getting started and you want to know who some really big, important people are that you should follow, definitely check out this list. It'll give you some good ideas. If you want to join the conversation, you can join us on Code Newbie Discourse, our online forum for people excited about code, or you can chat with us every week on the Code Newbie Twitter chat. Just search for hashtag Code Newbie and tweet with us every Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You can learn more about that as well as show notes on this episode at codenewbie.org/podcast. If there's a topic you want to hear about or a guest you want to hear from, send us an email, hello@codenewbie.org. Thank you again, Kristen, so much for joining us. You want to say goodbye?
Saran, thank you so much. A shout out to everyone listening. You guys are all awesome. Thank you so much for letting me be a part of this.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for listening. See you next week.